Hello, welcome again to Comic Con Stories. Tonight we'll be talking about editorial mandate. When is it needed? When is it unneeded? When does it go too far? When does it go not far enough? Of course, you know my co-host, JT from Saskatoon.
Hey, guys.
All right, and also with us is Red Ink.
I'm not ready for this.
All right. So, let's talk about the editorial mandates. What I mean, of course, is when the writing room of a comic book company, like one of the big two or the lesser, you know, couple like Dark Horse, Image, etc., has editors that manage the continuity between several different books of a shared universe and try to keep certain rules in line for all the books. So one writer can't do something that radically changes all the books. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean when I'm saying editorial mandate. A good example of this is when Post-Crisis first started, there was a mandate from up above that... Okay, I hear a lot of squeaking. Mandate from up above that Superman, Kal-El, Clark Kent is the only true survivor of Krypton.
In Earth 1, yes. And then they had the storyline where he went to the alternate Earth and killed that General Zod and brought the post-crisis Supergirl back.
Yes. But
never brought the post-crisis Supergirl back. He brought back Matrix, who's pretty much a clone of March from Manhunter.
So, anyways, as I was saying, that the editorial mandate of no Kryptonians other than Clark Kent, Kal-El, forced writers to do some pretty creative things because there were lots of classic Superman villains like the aforementioned Zod, who were Kryptonian, and other characters in the Superman supporting cast that were Kryptonian. So Post-Crisis had to either be clever about it or omit these things. This also went into other writing things. There were lots of other editorial mandates of the Post-Crisis universe. And
there's all kinds of stupid things. Like, Zod was not Kryptonian in the alternate universe. He was human that somehow got the opposite of Superman's powers. He was powered by a red sun.
That was you're talking about the Ed McGuinness run where of Superman, aren't you?
No, I'm talking about the same version.
Okay,
where Superman wears an executioner's hood and uncorks the green kryptonite that kills the three Kryptonians that were laying waste to that Earth.
No, different story.
Okay, yeah.
I'm talking about Supergirl's origin.
Oh,
okay.
I'm talking about all the stupid shit they would do during the time that Superman was supposed to be the only Kryptonian. They wouldn't even allow alternate reality Kryptonians. It was so bad that on the Superman the Animated Series, I think it was Paul Dini had to convince him that technically Supergirl wasn't Kryptonian. She came from a colony.
In the same planetary system, Argos. Argos was a sister planet of Krypton that froze to death after Krypton exploded. Honestly, I think that that was pretty good convincing because it pretty much won the argument. She's all but Kryptonian in name. And I think, honestly, if the writers at the time were that clever, they could have gone away with it. Even made her Kal-El's cousin by saying, "Oh yeah, they travel between Argos and Krypton all the time, etc." They could have gotten away with it because, but again, it's like, Paul Dini just has a talent for negotiating in really tight spots that I have to have some respect for. But editorial mandate is like that. The editorial mandate got so bad that a Christmas comic book was basically one of the head guys at DC had to draw this book so another artist wouldn't get fired. Let me give you the story. The story is basically Dead Man is really really fucking pissed off at Christmas because he can't go see any family and stuff like that because he's a dead man. And he meets a blonde girl that talks to him that can see him and talks to him and helps cheer his spirits up, and her name is Kara. The person who wrote this issue really wanted this issue to be done. And basically one of the real high-ups at DC, who used to be a Silver Age artist, drew this issue just because he knew that if if this was drawn by anybody else, they get fired. And they're like, well, they can't fire the boss, so I'm going to draw it. And some people, and the funny thing is the writing team and editorial actually tried to figure out a way to make this Christmas story that is incidental and inconsequential in continuity by saying, oh, Power Girl was in a coma, and it's her spirit that's talking to Dead Man or something. It really gets complicated, and basically the person at high up in DC says, guys, it's a Christmas comic. Give it a rest. Stop.
Because, you know, God forbid it should just be a simple tale.
Yes. No, I swear this happened. And I got to be honest with you. As for editorial mandates, the Superman is the only Kryptonian mandate I'm 50-50 with, because a lot of good creative decisions were made with it, but also a lot of really stupid restrictions on writers happened because of it, too. So... 50-50 on it. I think some good came out of it. What do you guys think?
I think some good did come out of it, because, I mean, you look at what's the Superman stories, like, pre-crisis, you know, besides the DC multiverse where, you know, everyone had their own alternate dimension. I mean, you had Superman, you had Supergirl, you had an entire petting zoo of super pets. Superman was... way overpowered. You know, he had like the micro Superman. He could shoot out of his palm when he wanted to have a day off. So I agree. Dialing it back like that was a good decision. I would like to think when they made that mandate, he's the only surviving Kryptonian. I don't think they were going to hold to it forever and ever, but I don't think it's a bad thing, but I do think it made the writers, you know, there were some really good Superman stories, some really interesting Superman stories that came out of that. You know, you had like the Day of the Krypton Man, where, you know, he, after Superman, like after he killed that alternate reality Zod, he went and like walk about in space and met this alien cleric that gave him the Eradicator that tried to make him into the ideal Kryptonian. And, you know, basically Superman had to realize, you know, as much as he's influenced by Krypton, he can't live the destiny of a dead planet. They had one of my favorites, the Crisis of the Crimson Kryptonite, where Mixia Spitlick gave Lex Luthor some red kryptonite, which robs Superman of his powers, and until Superman was able to get Luthor to break the curse or whatever it was that Mixie put on the red stuff. There's some really good stuff. I mean, what about you, Red? Do you think it was a good or a bad decision to do that?
Well, Ben said a lot of good came of it and a lot of bad came of it. To me, it seemed really annoying, because you'd have to come up with a good idea and then, no Kryptonians allowed. General Zod cannot be Kryptonian, blah, blah, blah.
He's Russian. Yeah. Wearing a red sun suit.
Yeah. Dumb stuff like that. Like, yeah. The idea... I think it's well impossible that General Zod's backstory still exists, that technically he's from Krypton, but he's also comes from the Phantom Zone. And you should look at it as Kal-El's the last survivor of Krypton, not the last Kryptonian.
Yeah. Last son of Krypton, but even then, that's not entirely true.
I think that's a fair statement. I think that there's other things that could have and should have been done with it. Zod is just, you know, if done right, is a really good villain, and you know, I think that I personally like the idea of Superboy being a human. I like that idea. I hate the idea of a Kryptonian Superboy, personally. Unless done right, unless done in a way where the character is good and compelling. Like, Kal-El, as everyone who listens to this podcast knows, he's one of my favorite characters. And I actually like the idea, hey, that's actually kind of clever, and all that. Matrix, I kind of agree that Matrix was a bad decision, and basically what happened after Matrix was introduced, everyone tried to fiddle with it to make it less like what John Byrne did, because everyone had problems with John Byrne did. And you had Peter David famously make her an angel. And that was... I don't know how to put it. Lots of people loved it when it happened, but in retrospect, in hindsight, I think that the Earth Angel thing was a mistake.
It was a big mistake.
I don't know. I kind of... Sorry, you go, Red.
I was going to say, I did like the Kara... the Kara Danvers version that they came up with that wore the animated costume.
Yes. That was after Earth Angel.
Yeah, that was when Matrix merged with Linda Danvers.
And they had her basically with Action Number One power set of leaping and shit. And, it's Kara Danvers was a good compromise. I personally think that, you know, if done right, if done with the right writer, a Supergirl from Krypton is not egregious. It's not a horrible thing. It actually helps a lot with the mythos, if done right. I just think that, at the same time, to put in perspective, before the New 52 started, the final issues and final storyline of the post-crisis Superman stories dealt with a Kryptonian colony on Earth. Yeah, all of a sudden had 5,000 Kryptonians living on the North Pole of Earth, and they were being assholes.
Yeah, because if I'm recalling correctly, that was the storyline where he finally uncorked the Bottle City of Kandor.
Yes.
And then they created... I don't know enough about astrophysics, and I kind of like the idea of the counter-Earth on the opposite side of the sun from us. So they build like new Krypton using the Kryptonian crystals. They build a whole planet on the opposite side of the sun from Earth. And so they had, for a time, Superman goes there to rediscover his Kryptonian heritage, and Mon-El and the Guardian, and then like this new Flamebird and Nightwing are protecting Metropolis. And, you know, Kal-El's got to work in the security force, and he keeps getting shit on by General Zod, who's like just trying to... I mean, some of the interesting stuff in that, but it resulted in turning General Sam Lane, who I always liked the cantankerous, you know, no daughter of mine should be marrying a lily-livered milksop like can't, like... Because he's kind of like DC's Thunderbolt Ross, and
they turned him into Thunderbolt Ross in that storyline.
Well, even more so, but they also turned him into a fucking Nazi. Like, I understand him not liking superheroes or Superman like that good, but I mean, he made him whole school. You know, all these Kryptonians, they're just going to screw us up, and we got to kill them first, because if there's even a 1% chance, we have to take it as an absolute certainty. That's not what he said in the comics, but he might as well have.
Oh, what's worse is what they did to Lois's sister in that storyline.
They turned her into a female Nazi with a fake Kryptonian power set?
Yes.
You know?
Like I said, it's... I was reading that storyline, and all I always said was like, gee, I miss that one Kryptonian rule so fucking much now.
Yeah.
But did Bobo Super Monkey come back?
They kind of played with in the Peter David Supergirl series. They did kind of play with the super pets, because
don't mention Comet. Don't mention Comet.
Fine, I won't continue my thought. Thank you for interrupting me and saving me from myself.
I'm saving the audience.
You mean Comet, who?
Oh God!
In the updated version, wore an Iron Man suit and was actually a woman posing as a guy?
Yeah. Yes.
There's more.
We don't have to go all the way into it, Ben, but they had Comet, they had Streaky the Super Cat, who was Kara's pet. I mean, they did some cool stuff in that one. I mean, one of my favorite issues was... there's an issue of that Supergirl that made me think, and editorially speaking, I think it was kind of a gutsy move to have this storyline where, was it Midvale that series predominantly took place in? I can't remember the name of the town in that series.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. So this guy, right-wing, you know, neo-Nazi, alt-right sort of guy comes to town, and all these people are protesting, and it's like, no hate speak, and even Steel shows up to, like, kind of give this guy the boot, and Supergirl stops Steel from doing it. It's like, look, we can't, like, we couldn't have the freedom of speech if we choose to not let everybody speak. So it became this whole thing about, you know, I don't have to agree with what you're saying, but I'll defend your right to say it, which was, I think, was a pretty interesting story. And for the editorial staff to let that get in there, I think was kind of a gutsy move, especially in the 90s when, you know, sales seemed to be more highly prized than, you know, stories like that.
I see.
Well, but, sorry, Red? Okay.
So another DC editorial mandate of the 90s we should talk about is after Hal went all crazy, there was a mandate of basically Kyle Rayner is the only Green Lantern.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, they held to that
for quite a while, honestly. Well,
7 or 8 years, something like that. Because, I mean,
it's quite impressive, honestly. And I think that's actually one that I disagree with. I understand why they did it. I understand that that they were trying to force certain storytelling styles there. I still disagree with it, but that is what they did. And how do you guys feel about that mandate?
I mean, I was reading, that's basically when, from Reign of the Superman forward, is basically when I got into Green Lantern for the long haul for the longest time. And I enjoyed that because, I mean, it's this guy, year one for Kyle. He has to find his own villains, his own way. He got some of his own villains. He got some of Hal's old villains. Like, he got a new version of, he fought the original Sonar, and then he got the new Sonar who had, like, the metal wiring and everything busting out of his skin. He got some pretty cool villains, like, is it Alex Nero, who's the, I forget what his particular mental health issue was.
He was schizophrenic, and I actually thought that was an interesting idea. A schizophrenic with a power ring, basically anything he, you know, what sort of things would be constructed from his twisted mind?
Well, yeah, or what do they call it, neuroatypical or something like that. You had Graven, who was like the illegitimate son of Darkseid, who I never really liked. I think my favorite villain that came out in this time of, you know, he's the only Green Lantern, was Effigy, who was basically the controllers, who are the asshole cousins to the Guardians created in, after the Dark Stars, they created the Effigy Corps, which are all these people with flame superpowers, but they wield flame like Pyro from the X-Men. And then eventually they had the, I forget what the it's a 5th week event, but Kyle eventually tried to create a new Green Lantern Corps. And it had, like, there was this female cosmonaut who had been lost in space, and I think it's the Shining Knight was part of this. And ultimately, he couldn't sustain the rings because it was after he went back in time and met young Hal Jordan in, like, year two. And eventually that, you know, it paved the way for when Geoff Johns took over and recreated the Green Lantern Corps. But, I mean, during that time, there was, I enjoyed the run by and large, you know, until he got, like, the spangly outfit and the dog collar costume because I just didn't like those.
With that storyline, I think that there are some interesting ideas that did work and others that definitely didn't work. I mean, we talk about villains. I liked, you know, I think if I had to pick a good storyline of that Green Lantern comic that I liked and appreciated, I think it was the story of Ion.
Oh, where he absorbed, like, the butt ton of energy and became all-powerful?
Well, I like the part where he fought Nero, and both of them were, like, were tapping into a greater power, and basically they had a... It was a war of, like, so many constructs that looked like a sphere.
Yeah, I recall that.
It was quite impressive, but again, one or two good issues does not make a good editorial mandate. What's your opinion on this editorial mandate, Red?
I gave zero shits. Nobody watched Green Lanterns except for super nerds like you guys. Or nobody read Green Lantern.
Wow.
Well, that's an honest opinion. That's cool. I mean, a lot of my friends weren't... I mean, I got teased by some of my comments. Like, not, like, really teased, but they're like, oh, you like reading Green Lantern? And I was like, yeah. That's all it was. But, I mean, this is at a time, like, that's why when Iron Man happened some 13 years later, you know, how they said he was a B or C list hero at this time, Green Lantern was at best a B list hero. He wasn't the as it's much as he was generous. In the Justice. I have no problem being generous. He wasn't as popular as other heroes, but he had his fan base, and Hal certainly had his fan base, because you know he had Heat. I forget what the set. I know the first version of that name was Hal's Emerald Attack Team, although that was later changed to something a little more not nearly as aggressive as that would suggest. I mean, around the time that Kyle came out, speak on something here, Ben.
Absolutely, go ahead.
One of my favorite things that came out of DC, and also got some from Marvel, but DC around this time in the 90s was... Because this is when I really, like, a few years before Death of Superman and Knight's Quest and all that, where Bane broke the Batman, you know, I was getting into these comics, and eventually, editorially speaking, you had, like, five different Batman titles. You had five different Superman titles. They kind of got shuffled off into their own corner of the DC universe. I mean, occasionally they, you know, the Ray or Mr. Miracle or the Red Tornado would show up in Superman. Occasionally, like, Anarchy or the Ragman would show up in a Batman comic. But they kind of had their own spheres of influences, and you never really stepped outside of Metropolis or Gotham unless it was, like, a big crossover, like the Bloodlines annuals thing or the Final Hour and such like that. And that's a time when, unlike now with a lot of DC titles, I didn't feel pressured by the editorial staff and the way the comics were coming out and the way the writing was, that I had to know everything else that was going on in the DC universe. I was happy just hanging out in the Batcave, hanging out at the Daily Planet like that, and reading these comics. I mean, granted, not all the stories in this time were good. I mean, a lot of people don't like No Man's Land. I happen to love No Man's Land. The storylines that came before Cataclysm and before that Legacy, and I forget what they called the one where the clench were like a super Ebola virus is ravaging Gotham City.
The Legacy virus, or was that another thing?
That was Marvel. Okay. I enjoyed the time. So, like, did you ever read the Superman or Batman around this time, Red?
No.
Okay.
There is some good things. Oh, I apologize for interrupting.
It's no, just... go right ahead.
All right. There is something good that came out of some of these ideas that they had with the idea of Superman Batman. Another editorial mandate you actually remind me of, which I actually think we should discuss, is there was a mandate in the early 90s to late 90s that Batman's official status, you know, official public status is urban legend. You know, we cannot verify or deny the existence of a Batman.
Who the fuck came up with this? Because it makes no fucking sense. One, he's a member of the fucking Justice League. The whole world knows about the fucking Justice League. You're like, oh, Batman's an urban fucking legend. He's on the fucking TV.
Well, no, I think they really just talk about that in, like, the GCPD just treats him as an urban legend. And around that time, I mean, this is after the I can't believe it's not the Justice League. Like, after, you know, the blue and gold era of Wahaha, you know, One Punch, laying out Guy Gardner, Batman wasn't so much in the public eye with the team anymore. So the argument could be made, but
there was an editorial mandate across all books. Basically, all books had to treat all Bat characters as urban legends, down to Robin on Young Justice. They had to come up with creative ways to hide Robin from being seen by anyone in the public in every issue of Young Justice. Peter David had to write some pretty crazy shit to make that work.
Yeah. What were you saying, Red?
As I was saying before you interrupted me, he also rides around Gotham in a fucking tank. How is that a fucking urban legend?
Oh my God. You got a point. I'm not going to pretend that it was a good idea. I think there was good intentions behind it. Because if Batman's mysterious, all of a sudden people won't know what he's capable of. That has a ring of a good idea. You know, become a legend. You know, the whole thing, like, become a myth. You know, just like they say in the Nolan trilogy. But I think they went a little too far in some places.
Yeah. And you look at the way the world was, the way the society is changing with the advent of the internet and the more and varied means of communicating with everybody. It's a campaign of disinformation. It wasn't me. Did you see me do it? It wasn't me. So it's a cool idea. It doesn't ultimately make sense because, as Red so eloquently put it, he drives a fucking tank.
Fucking plane.
Well, yeah, a plane. He had the Bat Rocket rail car when Azrael was Bats, like before he went nuts and created that gaudy armored suit with the one thigh belt and all that. It was a cool idea. And another thing that, editorially speaking, came out of DC around this time is the amazing success of the X-Files. And that gave rise to these four titles that were collectively known as the Weirdoverse, which was Primal Force, a new version of the Challengers of the Unknown, Fate, and I forget what the third one or fourth one was, but it's basically...
Is it with the Techno Skeleton guy?
Which Techno Skeleton guy?
The Detective Skeleton guy.
He works for
Superhuman Affairs for something. He's a skeleton, but...
Director Bones. He's a character from Infinity Incorporated in the 80s that they basically turned into the Smoking Man, or Cigarette Smoking Man. Bones has like this cyanide touch, and he's responsible for killing the original Star Spangled Kid, who was by then going by the name Skyman. But no, I'll have to look it up. I think it might have been a new version of an old DC comic, Night Force. But it was this thing, like they looked at the success and preponderance of paranormal based entertainment and decided to try their hand at that, and we got like the first version of the remake of Dr. Fate, where, you know, the guy shows up and he gets like the Ankh shaped scar in his eye, and he melts like the helmet of Naboo down and turns it into like this knife and some throwing darts, and he takes the fragments of the cape and wraps his arm because it's been basically it got the same disease that Ash got in Evil Dead when his arm's going nuts with like evil, like magic infected it or something. I never read that title. And I just kind of enjoyed that, especially the Challenges of the Unknown. I've always loved that concept. And the X-Files version that they did with this second generation of Challengers was really entertaining. And when you hop across the street to, you know, the House of Ideas, they did something similar with a lot of their Marvel heroes that... like DC did with Batman and Superman, where you had the Avengers family, and like, you know how Marvel Comics used to have like that, what do you call it, the indica up on the left, top left corner, where, you know, had like the Marvel logo and you had like that headshot, and then, you know, it's $1.25 for the comic, like back in the day.
Yeah.
All those logos, without getting special little bits drawn in there every time, if you were an Avengers-related title, like Captain America, Hulk, or Iron Man, you got the Avengers A logo there. All the, like, half dozen or so Spider-Man titles, you got, like, the Spider-Man logo. If you were even remotely related to the X-Men, you got an X symbol there, and it kind of editorially helped streamline these titles. So you had an edit EIC for all the Spider-Man titles, who would then, you know, confer with the EIC of the X-Men titles if they were going to cross over. And ultimately you went to the head, like the main editor-in-chief of all of Marvel. And again, it's, if you just wanted to read Spider-Man, you could read all the Spider-Man titles and not really be impacted by what's going on in X-Men. You could read what's going on in Iron Man and not worry about Wolverine coming up the works. And that's, I thought that was a really cool idea.
JT, you're on a tangent.
Well, no, I'm just saying that's what, I love that idea. I'm just rambling. I apologize.
That's fine. But back to editorial mandates. DC also had another really weird mandate in the 90s where they were like, we have to replace our existing characters with extreme versions of our characters. That's how we got, Death of Superman was part of it. The Rain was supposed to like be, let's make four extreme versions of Superman. And, Azrael Batz, obviously, and Artemis Wonder Woman. All sprung for this idea of let's extremize and get new versions.
It's also, again, spinning off, like, the Weirdoverse could also kind of be lumped in because they wanted to ride that gravy train. There's also, I remember there was a DC comic at the time called Firebrand, and it's, this guy was in this, like, weird jumped-up techno suit that he had, like, a flaming head and spikes all around the collar, and the only reason I remember that is because I used to read All-Star Squadron a lot as a kid, and they had the female version of Firebrand in there, and I was like, is that supposed to be related to that? And it just seemed like, why would you guys have this title come out? No one, was anybody really crying out for a new Firebrand title at that time?
Now let's talk about what happens with a lack of editorial mandate. Because now we talked about how editorial mandate, you know, creates some really weird situations. You know, some okay, some bad. Let's talk about where editorial mandate, like a lack of editorial mandate, like really, like where writers are able to do their own thing and basically really, you know, shit the bed. The only idea, the only example that comes out of my mind immediately, I know more are going to come as we talk, but is Dan Slott. Dan Slott in the aughts was able to get the She-Hulk title for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And Dan Slott decided he was going to quote, and I quote this quite liberal because this is what it was touted as, he was going to, quote, solve all continuity issues in comics, in Marvel Comics, in one issue. And he did this by revealing that there is a interdimensional travel agency where people in a non-powered Earth travel to the Marvel Earth as a copy of their superpowered selves. So that's this is why you have characters acting out of character all the time. This is why She-Hulk slept with Juggernaut. This was specifically for that. And the biggest problem with this doesn't solve problems. This creates a whole new bag of problems.
Okay.
Because
I think where you're going with this, but
all right. What do you think, Red?
I just think, just get the fuck on with your point. Stop stalling.
No, basically, because now you have an international travel agency where you have normies coming into the Earth with superpowers at any given time, and they could act completely different than the regular version of the characters. I think that you can't really do this as a one-off, one-issue joke or a one-off, one-issue explanation without deeper ramifications. The problem is it opens up a big, big problem. And nobody.
Hey, you're repeating yourself. Let me say what I thought you were going to say.
Okay, go ahead.
I thought you were going to say that Doc Ock is actually Dan Slott's fucking alternate version. And this whole time, when he's been writing Superior Spider-Man, he's been writing about himself. That's what I thought you were hinting at.
Actually, I wish I was thinking that. Thank you. But like I said, it's I think that sometimes when you let writers go too far without a leash, you're going to have problems. I think this is a problem that the current Superman book has, because Bendis has carte blanche as well. And you don't have a strong editor that's able to tell Bendis, who has celebrity status, mind you, as a writer, no, we can't do that. And that's why it's turning off a lot of longtime Superman readers.
You mean, besides for the fact that he split up Superman's family and hasn't even come close to explaining what the purpose of that storyline was?
Yes. Oh, and the worst part of it is they announced that he's going to do a new book about just some black chick.
Well, he's got that whole thing that he's got his own, like, imprint within DC Comics. That's Naomi. He's doing, there's a new version of Dial H for Hero, Wonder Twins, a new Young Justice comic, which I can't find out for sure whether any of these comics are in continuity or not. But, yeah, it's... I mean, I like a lot of stuff that Brian Michael Bendis has done, but yeah, there it's like, what's the name of the producer or whatever that reined in George Lucas? Like, you need somebody like that for Bendis.
His ex-wife, Marcia Lucas.
Yeah. Bendis needs a Marcia. Marcia. Like, somebody just go, less is more.
Or stop.
You know.
Please, yeah. God, stop.
There's enough there. Dear God, we can't get another warehouse to stockpile all your scripts.
But the biggest problem, again, is both comic book universes has a plethora of so many characters. And you really, and the problem with Bendis is if you let him, he creates new characters. And most of the characters he's been creating in the last, I'd say, 3 years have been shit. So by not reining him in, not having him write the existing characters, and having him create whoever he wants, you're just letting him flood your universe with shit.
I got an idea. Let's create a super smart black girl. It's almost like being smart is a superpower for black people. That's not racist at all.
And Marvel already did that with Moon Girl.
Riri Williams. He was going with Riri Williams because the new Teen Lantern is basically DC's Riri Williams.
Okay. I thought he was talking about that Naomi chick when he said that.
Well, Naomi as well, because basically he's selling Naomi as a book of, she is a bystander in Superman's life, but we want to read her story.
Why? Okay.
That seems like a really weird and, to me, hard sell.
That sounds like the algorithm that tells you what you want to see on your Facebook or all, you know, this is the videos you want to see on YouTube. Sounds like Bendis is just an extension of the algorithm. You know, you want to read this. You don't want to see interesting, well-written stories of heroes and villains fighting for the fate of humanity. You want to know about that girl that saw Superman fight Mongol that one time.
That literally is the first three covers of Naomi is a splash that you can put together of Superman fighting Mongol.
Okay, I didn't know that. I was just pulling that out of my ass.
No. Literally, that's what it is. If you look at the Naomi previews,
mm-hmm.
That's what it is Superman fighting Mongol. And basically, Naomi is supposed to be like fucking, what's it called? It's like DC's version of Damage Control. And I don't think anyone, like, fucking gave a damn about Marvel's Damage Control. I don't remember that book ever performing.
I don't know. What do you think, Red?
I don't know.
I honestly, the only time I've ever really cared about Damage Control was when they showed up in the beginning of Spider-Man Homecoming with, I think that was Cagney from, like, Time Daily. Like, Cagney from Cagney and Lacey was... Miss Arbogast, who famously is the take no crap from anybody, including Tony Stark, you know, his personal assistant for all those years once they had gotten rid of Pepper Potts for a time. So.
Any other examples of where editorial control should have stepped in?
you know, as much as I loved it, and I know you guys hate the Transformers IDW-verse, I definitely think that the editorial should have stepped in a little bit more in the last few years. Like, there was a lot of interesting ideas. Not all of them were good. Not all of them were bad. It just seemed like the ideas were piling up a mile a minute, and readers, including myself, barely had time to absorb one idea, you know, one new, this new, whatever new facet that had been put forward in a new issue of Transformers before you get the next issue and, like, another three or four have been uncovered. Like, I'm cool with peeling back the layers in a comic and creating, like, new parts of the mythology. It's just, it didn't seem, it seemed like the engine was running, but no one was, you know, behind the wheel. You know, because, I mean, there's interesting stuff, like, as we talked about in the Transformers episode, like, the whole idea that RC is a trans bot. You know, I thought that was a cool, that was an interesting idea, bringing gender to a race that, by and large, is, it's always been genderless.
RC is 4% more likely to commit suicide now.
Okay, that's a little lowbrow, Ben.
Please send all your email to BenCraftComics.
Yeah, but I mean, the idea is, like, and it was a cool idea to have that, because then you look at all the characters, like, they're all predominantly drawn, you assume them to be male, and they introduce this concept, that was so cool. And then you have Megatron becoming a pacifist, and then they introduce the idea of, like, sex and sex change bots as a lifestyle choice, and the concept of, like, they try to explain how Transformers are procreating or not, and give it actual religion to this race. And some of that was really cool, but it was too much too fast. So I definitely think a lot of, it's one of their most successful title licenses that IDW still has Transformers. They're just restarting their universe now. I just don't think editorial was on the ball the last 4 or 5 years of the Transformer comics.
You know, Transformers and religion is easy. They worship a 1980s rock band called Primus.
I'm cool with that. I mean, they introduced, like, vaguely religious tones. Like, when they introduced Vector Sigma in the second season of the cartoon, you know, it's like, it's the source of all Transformers and all that. It was cool, but again, like I said in the comics, no one was, you know, steering the ship. Can you think of any place where editorial failed or was too in control, Red?
A lot of fucking places. I think it's harder to spot some places where that didn't fail.
Well, if I may give an example where editorial not only dropped the ball in not controlling the writer, but dropped the ball by going too far in what they did. Let's talk about Quesadilla. And specifically, One More Day. Not just One More Day, but let's go back to the Goblin Babies, because that's really where the failing is. JMS, Straczynski, had this idea of doing a story where basically Gwen Stacy had children with, had a child with Peter Parker, and the child's now an adult and seeking some form of revenge. And Peter, you know, the story would have fit with the ages of the characters as they were. It's just, the problem is Quesada kiboshed the idea, because he thought that having an adult child would age Peter up. And what happened next was JMS should have said, okay, fine, let's throw that idea out completely and move on to another idea. JMS, however, comes from the television school of writing, where the idea is there is no bad idea. You have a room full of writers in a writing room, and they all pitch stuff, and they refine it until they have a good story. So he tried to do that with Quesada, and basically that's how he got Norman Osborn Goblin Babies. And that's, Quesada has a direct hand in that. JMS wrote the story, and JMS hates the story. He publicly disavows Goblin Babies. And while that's bad, it gets worse because when One More Day happened, you know, big continuity reset for Spider-Man. And JMS hated the idea, too, hated the idea of the deal to Devil, but also saw a positive of this. I can finally get rid of the goddamn Goblin babies. And, you know, Quesada, again, the editor-in-chief, said, hold on a minute, we don't get rid of villains. Villains are useful. So we keep the Goblin babies, but we get rid of the MJ marriage. So that's another example of editors and editorial mandate ruining something outright versus just through passively letting writers run amok. Thoughts, guys?
I can't disagree with that. I mean, I think after probably dealing, like being throttled back by editorial when he just had joined Marvel, you know, in the late 90s there when they created the Marvel Knights imprint, you know, and they had stuff like the Daredevil series that him and Palmiotti worked on, you know, I think he's bitter about that. So he's extending, you know, his dominance over this is like, it's my sandbox now. Because you look at stuff that came out of the Marvel Knights when they're there, you know, you had this like hand over fist success with Daredevil. So they did the, you know, Punisher Purgatory, which is the angel demon killing Punisher that isn't that good. I still don't know why they allowed that. I mean, I like the idea, but it's so dumb. And I think Quesada, because of the success he had in the indie comic scene with Ash and Painkiller Jane, and then coming up to Marvel, and I mean, he wasn't at Marvel for, it was less than 10 years that he was at Marvel, and by the time he became EIC, Jimmy Palmiotti had gone, you know, his partner, his brother-in-arms had left the company, and he didn't have, again, Quesada didn't have a Marcia, and he just did what he thought was best. He made stuff happen that he thought should happen. There's just no stopping the guy. And to add insult to injury, then years later to, you know, quiet all the fans complaining about One More Day, he wrote One Moment in Time, which was his attempt to show how Mephisto futzed with the Spider-Man history and why, you know, this is why Spider-Man and Mary Jane never got married. And again, no one was controlling Quesada. It's like, dude, really? Really? Like, he didn't have somebody on his shoulder just like, why? If not controlling him outright, just asking him, why would you do that? Because I guarantee if somebody had actually asked him that question, he had to stop and think about it for a second. Might not have, some of these stories might not have happened, or at least might not have happened the way they did. So.
There's some truth to what you say. You know, Quesada is a really good example. I mean, not just Quesada, but lots of things that happened in Marvel. There was lots of weird mandates. Like when Marvel was having the feud with Fox over rights to X-Men and Fantastic Four, there was some editorial mandates like you can't use the Fantastic Four for certain things, and you got to put them, you got to like basically shutter them away. You know, editorial mandate wanted to like quietly kill the book. The problem is you know, Marvel underestimated the love the fans had for Comics First Family. So Fantastic Four went on for a lot longer than the editors and management wanted to go on. After the Fox snafu, basically the X-Men were really in close to their own little alcove in the Marvel Universe, to where very few people wanted to reference them except for the most popular mutants, namely Wolverine. Basically all new characters with mutant or mutant-like powers became Inhumans, because they really were pushing Inhumans hard. There was a good year and a half where they were pushing Inhumans really fucking hard.
And yeah, that, more than a year and a half.
It was
like three fucking years.
Well,
three, 4 years.
But the most intense period was like a year and a half. You are right. It did go on for 3 years, but that's another example of editorial mandate. Basically, push the Inhumans, and nobody gave a fuck. More thoughts on that, guys.
Well, one, I'm not arguing for or against when I say this, but I wouldn't say that the editorial, it's not all editorial's fault. Like, that's Ike Perlmutter being a right royal bastard towards Fox because of how they were just not letting Marvel get anything back monetarily from, you know, that, like, we hold the rights to these characters. You know, you guys can make the toys and the comics, but, you know, so a large part of that is Ike Perlmutter, the head of Disney, saying, okay, you guys can play with the X-Men. And he walks in a room and he looks at, you know, Kasada and is like, okay, we're going to, you know, put the X-Men on the back burner. What about Wolverine? No. He stays out front. He makes us money. Well, the X-Men make us money. Not anymore, they don't.
That pretty much was really how it was. Because, again, I think we talked about this in an earlier episode. Comparing historically comic book sales, DC versus Marvel, DC always had, Batman always sold, Superman always sold. And with Marvel, like, pretty much Spider-Man and any title with Wolverine in it sold.
Yeah. And why do you think Wolverine joined the Avengers when Bendis took over?
That was partly because of that and partly because Bendis always wanted to do that.
Oh, this is true.
A little from column A, a little from column B. Red, you about to say something?
We're going to land in the Savage Land? Nobody lands in the Savage Land.
That's right. We're not landing in the Savage Land. We're landing in New Adelan. Oh, look, there's Black Bolt and Lockjaw. We haven't seen those guys in a dog's age. Ah, Lockjaw, dog humor. I mean, don't get me wrong. Pretty much the only thing I liked out of this 3 or 4 year push of Inhumans, and it wasn't the TV show, because aside from my favorite member of the royal family being very accurately portrayed in Lockjaw, there really wasn't anything else there that I watched 3 episodes and I checked out. I did like the Inhuman ongoing that they had started. The first five or six issues were, and I know they were drawn by, I don't think they're written by, Joe Madureira, who's an artist that came out of X-Men in the mid to late 90s. I've always been a big fan of his. So it was cool to see him come back to the House of Ideas and do something. But yeah, there's just, like, they tried to make, because they fully controlled the Inhumans, they tried to make that big push, which I kind of didn't think, because the whole idea with Fox, right, was, they have the rights to FF and, like, a literal crap ton of all the characters that are even tangentially related to that. That's why you didn't see Namor the Submariner in very much for all these years. You didn't see anything really with the Negative Zone too much. I mean, here and there, sure. But I always considered the Inhumans to be, you know, 2 steps to the left of the First Family, so you figured Marvel wouldn't have the rights to that, but, you know, because they had the full rights to it, they went, you know, whole hog, and you look where it goes. Like, did either of you guys watch the TV show?
1 episode. That was all. I even stopped halfway through, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I like I said, I toughed it out to the 3rd episode, which is almost half the series, and, well, that's 3 hours of my life I'm never getting back.
And, you know, again, with
Let's put it this way. I watched the whole fucking series. I don't remember any of it.
Wow, you just wiped it from your memory, huh?
I never wiped it. It just fucking went away.
Oh, it left no impression whatsoever.
The biggest problem that with the Inhumans was Marvel's was not only, you know, pushing them, because I like pushing the more esoteric books if you have a good writing team behind it, a good idea behind it. The problem is they were very blatantly and obviously, even to the short term, low visibility.
Are you going to say they're pushing the Inhumans again? Because you've said it like 5 times.
They were using them as a way to do mutant replacements. Is all I'm saying. It was obvious to all the readers, even the short term, just got into comics readers knew, hey, they're just using these as mutant replacements because they can't use mutants.
And they were gassing the mutants because the because I mean the Inhuman push happened after the Infinity crossover event where Atalan exploded and this huge Terrigen mist cloud is circling the planet. I mean, one good thing that came out of that was Miss Marvel, like Kamala Khan. I think we could all agree.
Her first series was pretty good, but after that, I'm going to say not so much. I think the biggest... And Kamala Khan actually ties into another editorial mandate that Marvel is still currently going through. There's currently 3 to 4 books Marvel won't let die. They perform for 2 years, get abysmal sales, and then they repackage and renumber one them with almost the exact same team. They've done this 3 times with Riri Williams. She's had 3 books. And each time they fail within 1.5 to 2 years at most, and then they repackage it. The new Wasp. She's had 3 books. She's had 3 books. And they still...
What was the third one? Because I know she's had 2 different Wasp titles.
She has a 3rd Wasp title. It just started. It has that the Japanese team on it.
I guess I hadn't heard anything about that.
Red's seen it. He knows what I'm talking about. They also are doing it with... I actually enjoyed Laura Kinney's 2nd book. Her first book was shit. Her 2nd book, they did it with her 2nd book. It had she's had 3 books. Laura Kinney has had 3 books in about 4 years.
So the one you're talking about that was all new Wolverine, right?
I enjoy it. There are writing problems with it. I'm not going to pretend it was a great book. I will say I enjoyed it.
Honey Badger.
Yes, I love Honey Badger, but. There's so many different Marvel is, every couple of years after abysmal sales, they repackage the same book and just put it out again. And it's happening. It's transparent. Certain books, they have to keep going just for the fans. Like X-Men, there has to be an X-Men title. Got it. Great. Perfect. There has to be an Avengers title. Good. Perfect. Oh, you can't not have a Spider-Man title, but Captain Marvel is another symptom of this. Captain Marvel has had 3 books in 4 years. 3 different books in 4 years. So that's a big problem. Is again the editorial mandate of we just got to keep giving this character titles. And I know I'm forgetting a shit ton of books that have this done. Red, which one can you think of that I'm forgetting?
I don't know. I don't care. I haven't been reading Marvel.
Okay.
Burn it all to the ground. Fuck it.
Yeah, there's... Like, I've made no small mention of my dislike for Carol Danvers. Like, I love Miss Marvel, Thunderbird, Captain Marvel. I've always kind of been a fan of the character. I'm not saying she isn't popular and she doesn't warrant her own title. And it's not the fact... I have no problem with her having her own title. Even the fact that she's had these 4 titles, the same thing with Nadja Pym, like Hank Pym's unknown daughter. It's... And again, this is one of the things, editorial speaking, this is one of the things that absolutely pisses me off about Marvel. Would you stop rebooting titles? Like, I don't care if you go from Marvel Now to all new, all different Marvel Now and all new Marvel Now. I get all that. I understand it's a branding thing, but do you have to restart a title every 2 years? You're not getting more readers in with the number one. You're not making any more money than you were before. If anything, you're driving readers and fans away with this constant restarting. Like, Again, I've never collected Captain Marvel comics, but I know some fans who are like, they dropped Captain Marvel because they're tired of... A lot of fans are dropping titles because they're constantly rebooting stuff like this. I mean, in the last 5 years alone, there have been at least 3 or 4 different volumes of Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah, The numbering is all over the fucking place because one book will start with the number one again, and then like a two issues later, it would be technically the same run, same artist, same writer, but it'll go up to 7:15, the next issue, and it's the next fucking issue. Venom did this as well. Venom had a number one, and then it went up to like Venom 436, next issue, but it's the same storyline, same artist, same writer. In the middle of a storyline, they do this.
Yeah. Now, I get why they're doing it. And the cool thing with Marvel, like, again, editorial speaking, this is something they've done that I do appreciate as a fan, is the legacy numbering. So I noticed this first on the current Doctor Strange title that I think Mark Waid's writing this one. And politics aside, it's been a pretty cool run of Doctor Strange stories. I've enjoyed it for the most part. But it's like Doctor Strange number 8, and then you'll see like Doctor Strange, I think it's like 236 or something. So when they reboot the titles, like they're counting that in the classic numbering. They did that when Spider-Man reached 800 at the end of the Dan Slott era a few months back, where you have this thing, it's like when they had the John Byrne Amazing Spider-Man in the 90s, and that kept going until so many, until they just clicked it back to the classic numbering, and then they rebooted it again. I appreciate that the editorial staff at Marvel is doing that, you know, continuity-wise. It's something I personally appreciate when you're keeping track of storylines in your collection and all that. But are you actually succeeding with this constant rebooting? Do you guys think they need to do this?
No. It's Marvel editorial taking what Stan Lee said, literally.
At face value.
Because Stan Lee said, every comic is is somebody's number one comic. So somebody heard that and was like, well, I guess we got to reboot every fucking series every year.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the reboot works, like, with... Now that they've got the rights to the X-Men and the FF back, you know, we've got a new Fantastic Four title, the two or three, you know, different X-Men titles that they were running, they've concluded those. We've got one, it's just Uncanny X-Men, we're going from there. You know, we might get, there's next new X-Force coming out. I've read rumors that X-Factor might become a new thing, even after, you know, Peter David gave a pretty satisfactory end to it a few years ago. So I appreciate when, you know, they're culling the herd, but they're still keeping something in there. But please don't reboot it again. Give it like 3 years, 3-4 years before you restart a title. Or don't. I mean, really, don't restart a title, because why in God's name would you need to?
That's a very good point. So any other final thoughts on editorial mandate, my friends?
Editors need Marshas.
Ah. Red?
No.
All right. Well, then let's wrap this episode up. This is your host, Ben.
JT from Saskatoon.
Frank.
And we're saying goodnight.
So long.
Peace out.